Let me introduce our speaker tonight, Lucas, whose home group is Solution on the Shore from Neptune, New Jersey. Hi, everybody. My name is Luke Mosley. I'm an alcoholic.
Hello.
Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
All right, great. I want to thank Jeff and the group for asking me back out to speak tonight. It's always a privilege and an honor to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous that helps to ensure my sobriety. And doing stuff like this is definitely one of those things that helps me stay sober today. But there are a couple of things that are a little bit higher on the totem pole of my sobriety, and I'll tell you about those. I've got a sponsor. His name is Anthony H. So if I say anything that offends you tonight, I'll give you his phone number after the meeting. Please take it up with him. I'm sensitive. I've got a home group at Solution on the Shore. We meet three nights a week. Actually, right now, I'm skipping out of the commitment I have. I chair our Monday night meeting. It's a big book study. It's more of a big book experiential kind of thing. But we go through the big book. We break it down line by line, and we have a speaker come in and share their experience with the text. Not so much telling us how to do it, but what their experience was while they were going through it. And we have a good time out there. That's in Belmar, right on the beach. Then Friday night, we have our 10 o'clock meeting. That's a step meeting, same kind of deal. Somebody comes in and shares their experience with the step. And then Saturday night's our big meeting. It's the main meeting, our one-hour speaker meeting. And that's been my home in Alcoholics Anonymous since I got sober. And because of all those things, I have the privilege and responsibility of sponsoring other men. And because of that, I've got a relationship with a thing that I call God today, and I call it God because it's kind of universally recognizable by people when you say it, although the thing that I call God probably looks a whole lot different than the thing that you point at when you're talking about it. And because of all those things, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink, a drug, or any minor emotion-altering substances November 10th, 2010, and I'm really, really grateful for that because stuff was weird before I got sober. You know what I mean? Like, it gets weird still some days. I get to run on the show myself and not using those things that I just told you about, not listening to a sponsor, and things start to get a little bit off. But I was out here a couple of years ago. I came out, and I was real nervous about coming out to this group. I had come to see my great-grand sponsor speak out here a couple of years prior, and I just remember the energy and the enthusiasm. And I'm happy to tell you guys that the energy and enthusiasm here is the same as it was a couple of years ago when I came out. So that's awesome. I've got the same experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. People call it a pocket of enthusiasm. And it's really all I've ever known since I got sober. I was fortunate to come into a room where young people were working out of the big book and believed in taking other people through the steps. And I think if I had found something different, my entry into AA might not have stuck. I see a lot of people come in and not stick to landing. And I think a big part of the reason I stuck around is because I had a lot of people surrounding me. It was really hard to fall off the edges. So a couple of years ago when I came out here, like right as the meeting started, like three carloads of people showed up from New Jersey. I'm watching now and I don't see any cars full of people from New Jersey, so I'm a little resentful. My man and my buddy Tim, he came out with me. A little nervous on that ride up here. You know, I tried praying before I left, but it's always like when you get in the car and you're thinking about traffic and what might come between you and getting here, you start running the scenarios in your head where you might be running in last minute. And then a sponsee called me and said something dumb, and I yelled at him, and that made me feel a whole lot better. And that fixes me every time. Like, that's it. I get on the phone with a sponsee. He tells me some knuckleheaded kind of thing, and I get on the muscle with him, and I remember what it was like to be brand new and how much things have changed. So with that stuff out of the way, let me tell you a little bit about my alcoholism. My alcoholism was alive and well before I ever took a drink. I've been weird since before I had a reason to be weird. I've been full of fear since before I had a reason to be full of fear. And that all started as a kid. I grew up in the mean woods of Jackson, New Jersey. You know, I've got a mom and dad that are still married today and love each other a whole lot. So that's really damaging, right? Because that's not the norm. Your parents are supposed to be divorced, so you have somebody to blame your drinking on. I've heard that a lot. So mom and dad gave me no good reason to drink. I've got four younger sisters who love me a whole lot. No matter what kind of dumb stuff I've done throughout my life, my little sisters still love me and think I'm a great big brother, so I can't blame them for my alcoholism. And basically, I come from all kinds of love and support and all the prerequisites you'd think you would need to be a well-adjusted and happy human being. But by the time I'm 4 years old, I'm none of those things. You know, I'm freaked out all the time. I feel a little bit off. I feel like I don't fit in my own family. You know, and that manifests in all kinds of weird ways, right? I'm always looking for ways to try to make myself feel better. And the first thing for me, the first rush I've ever got was sympathy. You know, if I can get one grown up one-on-one looking at me, worried about me, asking my favorite question, how are you feeling? I feel okay for a little while. So sympathy and concern were the first drug for me, the first thing that made me feel connected and not so apart from everybody around me. So I learned to get that by faking injuries, you know, by being sick. By the time I'm in school, I'm a nurse's office kid. Anybody else here a nurse's office kid? If you don't like to sit in class, just, you know, fake an injury. I still do that sometimes at work. If I look and it's only halfway through the workday and I don't feel like being there, I start limping until somebody asks me, are you okay? It's a lot less often, though. But it looks like this, guys. I start looking for different ways to make myself feel better from the very beginning. I don't know that I'm restless, irritable, and discontent because I just don't have the vocabulary for it yet. I don't get that until I'm 27 years old and I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and somebody opens a big book for me. But I knew that I felt off. And I knew that when people were worried about me, it seemed to go away a little bit more. And when I had that one-on-one connection with people, I seemed to be okay for a little while. I remember the first day of kindergarten. I remember getting on the school bus. And I remember the days leading up to going to school being all freaked out about it. I've got a twin sister, so I thought we would just sit together on the bus and that would make it okay. And I didn't figure out what was going to happen once we got there, but at least I got the bus ride figured out. But we get on the bus, and my little sister, I call her the little sister. She's 7 minutes younger. That counts if you're a twin. You understand that. She sits with this girl that I've never met before in a two-seater. And I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, I'm, like, freaking out. And I start walking towards the back of the bus. And I decide in my head if I get to the back of the bus and I haven't found a seat to sit in by myself, I'm just going to jump out the emergency exit of the bus, and I'm going to run into the woods. Spent a lot of time playing in the woods and building forts as a kid. I was pretty sure I could build a sufficient fort to start my life over again at 4 years old. But it didn't get that far. A kid let me sit with him, and he became my best friend. He was my best friend all the way up until high school. And just like the rest of my friendships, I don't walk away from people. I'm hardwired for loyalty. Usually people just go running out the exit door whenever I back away enough. And that's kind of the deal for me. I form these friendships where I latch on to people emotionally. I need you for support. I need you to make me feel better. I need you to take care of me. I'll never say that, but you get a funny feeling walking away like you're a dead battery and I just took everything you had. And I remember that with this first friend, you know. I would get pissed off if he hung out with other people, you know, on a Friday night. You know, you're my friend. We should be hanging out. We should be going to the movies. And just everything seemed heavy all the time. I didn't understand how everybody else had friends, how everybody else went to school, and was just able to kind of go through the motions and not get stuck the way I got stuck. You know, so that's just kindergarten, right? I remember like 13 years old going into middle school. Now, this is where it gets really weird because this is where the hormones turn on, and like even non-alcoholic kids get weird when they're 13 years old. But I got extra weird. You know, I didn't know what the heck was going on, but I knew that I felt better when I looked like what you wanted me to look like. If I could just seem to be into the same things that you were into, I felt a little bit better. You know, so I become that social chameleon. Whatever your favorite band is, that's my favorite band. Your favorite sports team is my favorite sports team. Your favorite color is my favorite color. And I'm telling all the stories to back that up. I'm talking about concerts that I've never been to, you know. And then I'm living in fear that you're going to figure me out for the fraud that I am. You know, I have to change groups of friends every couple of months because my stories start to conflict. They say, you know, I thought you said this was your favorite band. I thought you said this was your favorite sports team. And I'll say something contradictory and I get caught in it. So I just, my solution is to walk away from this group and I'll go over there and I'll start over again. In Jackson, there's more trees than people. So there wasn't a lot of groups of friends I could cycle through before I had to go back to the people that I grew up with and the people that knew me. And, then my biggest fear is that all these different groups of people are going to get together and compare notes, and you're going to figure me out for the fraud that I am, right? So I'm constantly running from the lies. I'm constantly trying to rewrite the story and justify the stuff that I've told you. And I've got this sneaking suspicion that everybody knows I'm full of it, you know, but I can't be honest. I can't let the story go. And that's, you know, that's 13 years old. And the next thing I start looking for at 13 is like something away from all of that. Something away from my group of friends. Something away from school. Something away from my sisters and my parents and my family. Because everybody's pretty sick of me at that point. And they don't want to listen to anything I have to say. So I go to church. And I didn't go to church because my family's religious. My mom and dad are not overly religious people by any stretch of the imagination. They are not atheists by any stretch either. They both have their own patent brand of spirituality. You know, my mom believes in like this real fundamental be good to people kind of thing. Strays, you know, stray people, stray animals, they're all welcome to live in my family's house. Mom and dad are both blue-collar workers. Mom's a cafeteria lady. Dad works in construction, and they've done that since I was a little kid. And with five kids running around and blue-collar income, where I come from, it doesn't put you ahead of the game. That's for damn sure. And that never stopped them from taking people in and taking care of people. I remember my mother was always bringing in friends of hers that were down on their luck. Or, you know, I remember one time she had a friend who was going through a nasty divorce, and the woman and her two kids came and, like, they lived in our living room. My mother put a sheet over the entryway to the living room, and that became their little apartment in the middle of our house. Barely even noticed them with the seven other people that already lived there in the one bathroom we had. But that's my mom, right? She gives everything she's got, even if it puts her at a disadvantage. And I'm not hardwired for that. My dad, he's a little bit more out there than my mom with the spiritual stuff. He believes in the Force from Star Wars. I think that's pretty cool. I can dig it, you know. It's all energy anyway. But from the time I'm a little kid, I've got the difference instilled in me between right and wrong. And more than that, pushing me towards trying to be a good person. Try to take care of the people around you. You know, it wasn't good enough not just to not hurt people. You had to go out of your way. And I don't know why that never stuck for me. But I end up going to church because, not because, you know, I'm trying to be a better person or I'm trying to learn anything, but I'm looking for a group of grown-ups that haven't heard my sad stories yet. I'm looking for a new group of people to impress. And I find them. I go to this church and I hear people talking about a different book than we've got in AA, but, you know, a pretty substantial book. I don't know if you guys have heard of the Bible, but that's what they're talking about at this church that I went to. They were talking about a different guy. It wasn't Bill Wilson. But they all seemed to really like this dude, and they supported him and his teachings. And, you know, I did what I've done my entire life. I decided that I was going to learn just enough to sound like I knew what I was talking about, you know, and I was going to go to church every Sunday, and I was going to sit next to the pastor and the pastor's wife. And after a couple of weeks, they're really impressed with me. I'm pretty impressed with myself, to tell you the truth. So I would go there, and they would ask me to do little things on a Sunday morning, read this, do that, light the candles, you know, pass a collection basket. And I started to find a little bit of a sense of purpose and a little home there, you know. But what I never felt was this connection to this thing that they were talking about. And rather than tell you guys that, rather than show up and say, hey, there's something missing here, I just fake it because I think that's what you want me to do. You know, I think you want me to show up and pretend I'm a part of and say the things that you're saying and talk the way you're talking. And before you know it, my conception of this higher power is that it's really just a talking competition, that we're going to show up and we're going to see who can speak about it the most eloquently, you know, move people to laughter and move people to tears. But either way, you got to get a reaction in the way you talk about this thing. So I get really good at a young age of talking about things like I care about them, you know, convincing the people around me that I'm passionate or I'm engaged or that I care. And, you know, that all came crashing apart for me. There was a youth retreat that we did one summer. We went out to this place in Jersey called Mount Misery. And it's like pine forest. You know, you go out there, there's sand everywhere. There's not a beach for miles. There's mosquitoes and pine flies and little log cabins without air conditioning or electricity. It's an awesome place. You know, so we go out there, and the first night we're out there, there's a pastor, and there's a service, and there's music, and there's all kinds of, like, it just felt like a pep rally, high energy kind of stuff going on. And he gets up there, and I remember this night really vividly because it was the first time anybody had ever given me words that kind of fit that thing that was going on in me, right? I'd gone to therapists, I'd gone to counselors at this point, I'd gone to the guidance counselor a lot because the nurse would send me back to class. So I went from nurse's office kid to guidance counselor's office kid. And then security office kid and principal's office kid. Like, wherever I can go and talk to a grown-up about my day is good enough for me. But, I mean, therapy outside of school, I'm going and I'm seeing all these different therapists and all these different counselors and social workers and the child study teams involved. And they're telling my parents, maybe you got to pull them out of public school. But everybody's got a different word for what I'm experiencing and what I'm feeling. You know, and a couple of them got diagnoses, and some of them have even medications that go along with those. And I wear these labels around for a little while, and I try their medications out. And at 13 years old, nothing really spoke to that thing in me that I knew was there. I just couldn't put it into words what I was experiencing. And then I heard this guy talk about it. You know, this pastor gets up there and he says, anybody who wants to be saved, come to the front of the room. And I told you, I'm already cool with my pastor, right? We're on a first name basis. So I say, Bill, what's he talking about? And he says, Do you know that part of you that feels like there's something missing? There's got to be something more in life. And I just said, yeah, I know that part. And he said, that's the part of your heart you haven't given to this higher power. And once you do, kind of like the promises in the big book, the steps of every promise all rolled into one. He told me I was going to know that I was going to be okay. I would be okay, and I was going to know that I was going to be okay. I was going to find a purpose. I was going to find a connection. I was going to feel loved. Everything was going to be a little bit less scary. And I said, dude, what do I have to do? Sign me up. And they told me a prayer to say, and they told me what to do. And I took those directions from those people on that night, wholeheartedly, 100% wanting to experience this freedom that they were telling me about. And I said that prayer and nothing happened. You know, and I've got a lot of ideas today about why that didn't happen. Most of it looks like exactly what the big book talks about here. You know, lack of action to back up that decision. Contempt prior to investigation. Not being able to let go of old ideas. Being closed-minded to the spiritual terms that they were talking about there. You know, but really what it comes down to is my mouth is moving and my feet aren't. So at 13 years old, I've already gotten good at coming up with explanations for why things are the way they are and why things were unfair, because none of it's my fault. I've got bad luck. I've got bad timing. And most of all, you just don't understand, right? So at 13 years old, when I say this prayer and nothing happens, I got to find somebody to blame. So it's got to be one of two things, right? It's got to be either that A, God is not real and you've all been full of crap. You've been lying to me, talking about this thing, feeding me a line of BS since I got here. And I like that because that gives me a room full of people to be resentful at. Or B, God is real and he wants nothing to do with me being okay. You know, and that scares the heck out of me. You know, going back to this happy childhood that I had, right? There were blips on the radar of my childhood. It wasn't all perfect all the time, you know. I was molested when I was 4 years old, from 4 to 6 years old. There was a couple of instances of molestation there. A family friend. I didn't tell anybody about that until 13 years old when I'm going to these guidance counselors. And I really didn't bring that up because it was troubling me so much. It was just a sad story to tell the grown-ups, right? And that got me a bunch of attention I wasn't expecting really fast. I remember my father coming up to me one day. I didn't realize we were going to tell him about what I had told the counselor that day. And he said, did you tell them this? And I said, yeah, I told them that. And he had some choice words for me. You know, basically what my father wanted me to understand was none of that happened. You know, he said that never happened. You're never to talk about it again. And it was a heavy moment. You know, I look back at it today and I know that my father loves me. My father's never not loved me. And in that moment, I think my dad freaking out the way he did was just a man's inability to protect his son. You know, years earlier, he couldn't go back and undo that. So my dad does what he does best, just try to make sure that we don't think about it, don't look at it, and move on and hope it never happens again. You know, but I got the crap knocked out of me a lot, too, and most of that was my fault. I was a pain in the neck. My dad would beat the crap out of me, and he told me years later that he was just trying to beat the stupid out of me. I give him a lot of credit for trying. He never succeeded. You know, I held on to a whole lot of my stupid. What I did lose, though, was the fear of being hit. And that is really evident in the way I talk to people sometimes, especially sponsees. I don't care how long you're home from prison or how big you are. I got a fearless mouth. I might be shaking on the inside, but you know, I got a real big mouth. You know, so this stuff is going on, right? Things were not perfect, but in that moment that this prayer doesn't work, right? That's the way I would have explained it to you back then. As I said this prayer, nothing happened, nothing worked. I start to look at these things. And I start to evaluate them as maybe these are the reasons why I can't feel peace, why I can't feel this presence, why I can't be saved. You know, and that throws me more internal than I've ever been before. That throws me into a level of self-consciousness and feeling less than, worse than I had ever experienced up until that moment. You know, for me, it really felt like a spiritual disconnect. So when I walked away from there, I was angry. I had this huge resentment with God. I had this huge resentment with church. I had this huge resentment with religion. I had a huge resentment with my pastor, who was like the only guy who was hanging on to me at that point in my life. You know, my family is just terrified of me. I'm showing up in psych wards at 13 years old. You know, before I ever picked up a drink or a drug and showed up in a detox or a rehab, I was showing up in psych wards. You know, there was a lot of self-harm there. There was a lot of crazy behavior and nobody knew what to do with me. And this was a guy that would sit quietly next to me and not bat an eye, no matter how nuts I got. And once I was ticked off at him, like, I didn't feel like there was anything tethering me to any kind of sanity anymore. So I kind of go off from that moment with this huge resentment. And the next thing I find is alcohol. You know, I'm like 13 and a half years old. My little sisters have some friends over. And there's a quiet part of the house that night, right? And that's how you know there's trouble in the house, because there's somewhere where it's quiet. With all the dogs and cats and people running around our house, if there was a quiet spot, you knew that was the party. And I walk in the room that night, and they've got this cheap bottle of tequila. And they're about to open it. So, you know, I was, big brother showed up just in the nick of time to take the bottle away from them and ruin their party. And I'm going to show them how it's done. Now, mind you, I've never been drunk before. You know, I've had a couple of sips of beer off my dad's mug off the table. I finish my mom's wine cooler if she leaves and walks away. At the end of the night when mom and dad are going to sleep, I remember they'd send us to bed and they'd watch TV. And if I woke up late into the middle of the night, on the kitchen counter there would be the whiskey sour glasses with some, you know, melted ice in the bottom. Take sips off of that. But I've never been drunk. I've never felt the effect created by alcohol until this night. You know, and it happens like this. I take the bottle away from them. I tell them, you're too young to be drinking. And they're all looking at me, expecting me to do something. So I think I better get to it. I crack the bottle. I take a couple of sips, and it's really nasty. And I just start thinking, how am I going to do this? You know, I don't think I got it in me to take another sip off this bottle. So I take it out to the kitchen. I find some iced tea powder. Funnel the iced tea powder into the bottle. Shake it up. I take another sip, and it's still really nasty, but it's sweet, and I can keep it down. So I start to drink, you know, and they're watching me. And the more they watch me, the more I want to impress them. And the more I want to impress them, the more I know I got to drink. And I get real brave, and I take a big gulp, and I remember the burn as I swallowed it. You know, and before you know it, that burn started to move into my chest, and there was a warmth and a glow. And I take another big gulp off that bottle, and the next sensation I get is... because at 13 years old, I get the first deep breath in my entire life. I told you before that I didn't have the words for what was going on with me. But in that moment, I knew exactly what it was. I was too concerned with what everybody in the room thought about me all the time. You know, the big book calls it the bondage of self. And in that moment, I was free of it for just a little while. The problem with that is I always overshoot the mark, because I'm the alcoholic that the big book talks about. And what that looks like out of our doctor's opinion is, once I start, I don't know when I'm going to stop. Once I stop, I don't know when I'm going to start again. And the whole time between the last one and the next one is filled with this obsession that if I just get the next one, maybe everything will be okay. I know it looks like a mess right now, but let me get enough space between you and me, enough space between me and this world that up until this moment was too close, too loud, with too much expectation, too much fear. I take a couple of sips, and I can't run faster, jump higher, dance better. None of that stuff. I just don't care what you think about me anymore. And that's the closest to freedom I've ever been. 13 and a half years old, couple of shots of cheap tequila. You know, but this phenomenon of craving takes over, so it doesn't stop with that feeling of relief. What it ends with is me blacking out, you know. And the nature of a true blackout is I don't remember this. I'm told about it the next morning. In the beginning, that was humorous, right? It was like you teleported to another place in time, and you laughed about the dumb stuff you did. And what my sisters tell me is that night I got nice and drunk. I climbed up on the bunk beds. I jumped down and landed on my face. My lip was split open and I was bleeding everywhere. They screamed, I laughed, and I did it again. You know, let's lather, rinse, repeat for the next 15 years. I'm drinking to impress you. I'm drinking to outdrink the guy standing next to me. I'm drinking for the show that I'm going to put on when I do it. But most of all, I'm drinking to overcome a phenomenon of craving that I don't even know exists until you try to take that bottle away from me. And then it shows up and it's violent. You know, so I wake up the next morning and I'm laying in the bottom of the bathtub and the shower's running cold on my back and there's puke in the drain and my head is throbbing. The first thought I have is, how did I get here? And the very next thought is, when can I do that again? And in the beginning, it wasn't the very next night. I don't even think it was the very next weekend. It was probably a couple of months before I got my hands on a bottle of something again that I could experience that thing. But I remembered it. You know, I remembered that sensation of everything's going to be okay. You know, and I thought about that ease and comfort a lot. By the time I get into high school, I'm drinking almost every weekend. The friends that I hang out with, the places that I go, the things that I do are to put me in a position to drink with you this weekend. And it wasn't death and destruction. I had a great time drinking in the beginning. You know, alcohol was not evil. Alcohol did exactly what alcohol does. It gives me an effect that I enjoy. You know, and that's why everybody drinks. Everybody drinks because of like the effect created by alcohol. But it's what it does for me, you know. It's the fact that I've got this shift in perception where the world looks a little bit easier to deal with. You know, I talk to my grandmother, you know, she'll have half a beer. She'll It's the weirdest thing in the world. She'll come to a family party. She'll look at my grandpa and say, "You want to split a beer?" Why would you split a beer? I don't get it. But I ask her, "Why don't you drink more?" And she says, "Because I get too full." That's another thing I've never had a problem with. I don't know too full. But she says the same thing that a lot of people say that are not alcoholics. She says, "I start to drink, I get hot, I get dizzy, I get sweaty, and I feel like I'm going to lose control." They don't know that if you just push through that, that's where the fun starts, right? There's a magic spot for me in the very beginning between like 8 and 15, right? That if I could just get there and stay there, I'm going to have a good time, you know? But I hit that spot and I go way past it, and I wake up naked in my family, my family's living room, or I wake up naked in my best friend's little sister's bedroom on the floor. All funny stuff, right? We can laugh about that. I'm 16 years old, and ha ha ha, he's just a kid. He drinks too much, and I wear it like a badge of honor. I like to party more than the next guy, rah, rah, rah. But it doesn't stay that way, because the other thing the Big Book tells me about my alcoholism is it's progressive. Not just in the amount that I drink, right? Because that may or may not be the case for me. I may start to drink more. I may not start to drink more. I may become an everyday drinker, or I may not become an everyday drinker. The truth for me is I never became physically addicted to alcohol. You know, out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not going to run you through the long list of things that I did become physically addicted to. But I think it really is important for me to draw a differentiation here. I drank alcohol alcoholically, right? I drank alcohol because it had an abnormal effect for me. I did drugs because they had the expected effect for me. You know, if you take my mother and feed her the drugs that I was taking, she would become physically addicted to those drugs. And there was a different effect for both of those things, right? Alcohol for me was always the thing that made me feel like life was just starting to happen. Like I was a part of, and I have a couple of more drinks, and I love you, man, and everything's awesome. And I'm shaking my friends to keep them awake at 4 o'clock in the morning because now we're really living. You know, and I wish everybody could just stay this way and everything would be all right. If we could all just be drunk all the time, everything would be happily ever after. That's really the way it feels for me. But drugs were like a totally different thing. Drugs were because I wanted to be alone. Drugs were because I could no longer deal with the consequences of my drinking. The progressive nature of this thing, right? I remember in the beginning that I would drink over the guilt, shame, and remorse that I had about the stuff that I did yesterday and that I did a week ago and that I did a year ago. And by the end of my drinking, I'm drinking over the guilt, shame, and remorse over the things that I know I'm going to do tomorrow. You know, because I crossed this invisible line where I can't shut it down anymore. And I know that means that I'm going to do absurd things to get the next one. I'm going to take advantage of the people that love me. I'm going to hurt the people that are trying to take care of me. And I'm going to get the next one. And at a certain point in my drinking, it's inevitable. And what happens at that point is I just kind of succumb to this thing. You know, and that was kind of a slow progression for me. It wasn't like I woke up one day and alcohol stopped working. It wasn't like I woke up one day and the consequences got too great. It's kind of like my great-grandsponsor talks about boiling a frog. You know, you throw a frog in a pot of boiling water, he's going to hop right out because he feels the heat. But if you put him in there and then turn the pot on slowly and start cranking that up slowly, 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 incrementally, he's not even going to know he's cooking in his own juices. You know, so it took me from the time I'm about 21 years old to the time I'm 27 years old to be fully cooked. Because at 21 years old, I go to college and I give it a try and I try to be a grown up and I fail out of there and I go back to mom and dad's house and I get a job and I get an apartment and I start making some money and everybody's cheering for me. You know, the college thing didn't work out for him, but he's going to be successful. He's going to be okay. He's really responsible. He's doing the right thing. And then a year later, he's not doing the right thing. A year later, I'm going into rehab. This is probably the second time I ended up in rehab, 21 years old. And in that rehab, they talked to me about a lot of things. Things that I don't know to be too relevant for me today. Right? I think they were talking to a different kind of guy. If I look at page 21 of There Is a Solution, I start to see them kind of break this thing down into different kinds of drinking. And I see that the thing that I've been looking at for a long time is the hard drinker. I think that I'm the hard drinker. I think I'm the guy that parties too much and gets carried away. And if I get a good reason, maybe I'll be able to shut this down. You know, one day I'm going to have to just straighten up my act and be a grown up. And I've tried that so many times, you know. In the beginning, it took me 2 years to run into the ground. And then it was a year. Then the next time it was 6 months before I ended up back in a detox again. And then it was 3 months. And for the last couple of years, like it's a 30-day cycle of build it up, tear it down, build it up, tear it down, build it up, tear it down. I get kicked out of the apartment that I'm staying in because either I get evicted or the friend's couch that I'm staying on throws me out. I got to go find somewhere else to go. Usually that means 2 weeks in mom and dad's house, and that's not because they're inviting me back home because they love me so much. It's because I bully my way back into the house and then I'll lock the doors to keep me out. You know, and I get back on my feet again and everybody says the same thing. This time it's going to be different. He really learned his lesson. He's gonna try harder. And I do. I try harder. More self-will. More Luke applied to every situation in my life. And I can't figure out why it keeps crashing down. You know, so at this point, probably 23, 24 years old, things just start to take on a different flavor. I used to think of myself as a guy with a lot of potential because that's what my family told me. I thought that there were great things in store for me. I was going to find a great job. I was going to be able to get my life together. I was going to live up to some of this potential. But around 23 or 24 years old, I had just kind of given up. You know, I was going to become something different. And to me, that looked like a career alcoholic. I just wanted to drink as much as I needed to. I looked at the world and everybody in it like you were in my way. And I started saying things to people like everybody's got their medicine. You got people on antidepressants. You got people taking this, people taking that. This is my medicine. This is what works for me. And, you know, my family goes from supporting me and loving me and being there for me on every stupid decision that I make and just crossing their fingers to just like, Luke, we love you, but you're on your own. And slowly, 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 I started to see the people that have supported me my entire life stepping away. And when that happens, right, when people start moving away from me, I grab onto them. You know, I grab you, I shake you, I take you for every last thing that you got before you leave. And, you know, I move away. I move back up to North Jersey. I got some friends up there. I make a mess up there. I got to run away from that. I move back down here. Make a mess down here. I move back up there. And for the last couple of years, I don't have a job. You know, I've got different ways that I'm making money. Most of them are illegal. None of them are respectable. One of those times that my parents let me come back home for a little while, I drained their bank account. These parents have worked blue-collar jobs and never been able to save and have been bankrupt before. You know, they put every dollar away for the mortgage and for the bills coming due. And when I go to the bank account and I take the debit card and I open up the account and I see that there's $1,800 in there, you know, I justified in my head, oh, they got $1,800. You know, that's savings. I don't have anything. I'll take half of it. I'll put it back on payday. You know, all these stupid little things that I tell myself to justify doing the stuff that I'm doing. And I drain their bank account, you know, and it breaks my mom's heart. You know, so I move far away again because I can't look my mom in the eyes anymore. And I find myself living with a woman. We get engaged. We got engaged not long after I lost the last job that I had. I saw that I needed to do something strategic right there. You know, I had no income and I needed a place and she had a place and she had a car. And slowly her things became the things, became our things, became my things. You see what I did there? You just change a couple of words, guys. It's alcoholic possession. You just you talk them into giving their stuff to you. You know, I would say, Suzanne, can I take the car tonight? Suzanne, I'm taking the car tonight. It's just, you know, subtly over time, she just doesn't even want to fight me anymore. You know, so by the end of this thing, I'm 27 years old. I'm living with this fiance who is absolutely in my life because I need a caretaker, and she's just hasn't walked away from me yet. And I'll come home from doing what I got to do, and she'll say things like, Luke, is there anything you want to tell me? And I say things like, Suzanne, is there anything you want to ask me? And that usually backs her off, the tough guy routine. You know, and I'll never forget, I came home one night, and I guess she was feeling extra bold. She said, is there anything you want to tell me? I said, is there anything you want to ask me? And she said, yeah, I want to know about the secret email account that you have. I put this password detector thing on the computer. I'm telling you, she was out of line. Long and the short of it, she kicks me out because she found out I was gay, right? Complete overreaction to a situation we could have worked out. You know, just because love and tolerance is our code doesn't mean it was her code that day. She's an unreasonable person, very selfish, threw me out of my ass. And as she's throwing me out the door, I said to her, Suzanne, if you really love me, we'd be able to work through this. And every fiber of my being believed that to be true and reasonable. You know, this is the depth. This is the depth of my delusion. This is the depth of my insanity, right? So what? I'm gay. I've committed to marrying you. I don't even particularly like you, but I'm going to start a life with you. We can have some kids. Our families will be happy. You can be happy. Just don't ask me too many questions, like what's up with the secret email account? What's up with the marks on your arms? Mind your business and we'll be okay, Suzanne. She disagreed. The car became her car. The apartment became her apartment. She took all her stuff back, and I do what grown men do. I cried to my mother. She said, "What did you do to that woman?" And I said, "Nothing, Mom. It's all her fault. She's unreasonable." Really, truly believing that I got dealt a bad hand, that it was bad luck, and I was a victim. You know, the big book talks about fear and the decisions that I make and how it's shot through the fabric of my existence, right? And I see that 13 years old, I start to realize that I'm gay. You know, and I start to pray and I start asking this God that I don't even believe in at that point to change me. God, just make me straight. Please don't let this be the hand that I'm dealt. You know, and because God doesn't change me right then and there, I decide that, you know, I'm being punished. So my sexuality is punishment, right? I'm already damaged because it's probably because I was molested when I was 4 years old. You know, so I'm gay not because I was born this way and that's, you know, in my DNA or my genetics, but because I'm damaged goods. So I've got this huge shame-based kind of identity just below the surface that I'm drinking at every single day. You know, that's not what makes me alcoholic. You know, I'm not alcoholic by circumstance. I'm not alcoholic by luck. I'm not alcoholic by, you know, hurt feelings. I'm alcoholic because of that phenomenon of craving. That's it. But I'll tell you what, alcoholism is a really convenient tool to throw at stuff like that that shows up along the way. The stuff that I don't want to deal with, the stuff that I don't want to be honest about, I sweep it all under the rug. I drink enough to not talk about it. When it comes to the surface, I say, back off, I'm an alcoholic, it's a disease, leave me alone. And that becomes my battle cry at 27 years old. If you understood what it felt like when I stopped drinking and putting this other stuff in my body, you'd buy me the next one. If you really cared about me, you wouldn't question it. Mom, just let me come home. And she says, Luke, you're going to have to tell me something you've never told me before, because I've fallen for this many, many times, and every time you come back, my life is a little bit worse because of it. You know, so I move back into Mom and Dad's house, and, you know, I tell her it's going to be different this time. And it was. I waited 2 weeks before I drained their bank account again. And the saddest part of that deal was this, guys. These parents that I vilified, that I ran around telling everybody were terrible, terrible people that didn't love me enough, never supported me, beat the crap out of me, threw me out when I was 16 years old, never really accepted me. This big, sad story that I tell, the truth of the matter is this. When I took that debit card out of my mother's purse while she was laying in a hospital bed and I was showing up to be a good son and check on her, when I got to the ATM that day, the PIN number on her debit card was the same as it was as the first three times I drained the bank account. I asked her about that later. Mom, why would you do that? Why would you set me up like that? And she says, Luke, if I change the PIN number on the debit card, it would mean that I've given up on you. When you tell me that it's going to be different, I have to believe you because it's all I got. Man, that's a game changer. I'll never forget the first Christmas I had sober. I went home with my family from the halfway house. My mother picked me up on Christmas morning. And she said to me, Luke, you have no idea what it means to me to have all my kids home and safe for once. It's the first time in years that I'm not worried that you're dead somewhere. And I said, no, Mom, I know. It's great. And she looked at me and she fired back and she said, you do not know and you'll never understand. And I was like, whoa. And my mother said something to me that morning that really changed the way I looked at my alcoholism, because up until then I was the only victim, you know, even a little bit into sobriety. And she says, Luke, there were days that I looked at you and I watched the way you were suffering and I prayed for you to die because I couldn't watch the pain you were in. I knew the pain was so bad that death would be better for you. You'll never know what it's like to be a mother who's praying for her only son to die so he doesn't have to struggle like that anymore. And she's right. I'll never know that. God willing, I'll never know that. You know, but at that point, the only thing I cared about was the fact that I had to find a place to go. Mom and Dad were calling the cops, so I went to detox in a hurry. You know, I never made a noble decision to turn my life around so fast as I have when the cops are on the way. It's time to do it. It's time to be a grown-up again. And October 21st, 2010, I show up in a detox. October 21st to November 10th, there's a little stretch there. October 21st was not my sobriety date, and there's a really simple reason for that, guys. It's not because I didn't want it bad enough. It's not because I wasn't willing. It wasn't because I wasn't done yet. It wasn't because I couldn't put the plug in the jug. It wasn't because I didn't pick up the phone and call somebody before I took the next drink. It was none of that stuff they were talking about in the rehab. It's really simple, and it comes down to this. I had a case study on unmanageability in that first step, and I had nothing of powerlessness. Because up until that very moment, no matter how bad it got, no matter how great the consequences internally, never really wanted to stop. I don't know what to tell you guys. Watching my mother cry, terrifying the people around me, hurting people, doing despicable things, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, day after day after day to get the next one. Still wasn't enough. Because it's not consequences, it's not fear, it's not frothy emotional appeal that gets me sober. It's a moment of grace and an understanding of powerlessness. And that didn't happen until November 10, 2010 for me. And the way that looks like is this. I get out of the treatment center, into the halfway house, I get scared. And as much as I wanted to be sober that morning, and I would have swore to you that I'm starting over again and I'm never going to go back to that, I've learned enough about alcoholism and addiction and my family's genetics and all this other good stuff, triggers, coping mechanisms. I still got packets. I take them out sometimes when I'm feeling bad for myself. Don't tell my sponsor that. They gave me a lot of worksheets and a lot of dittos and a lot of stuff to do when I was in that rehab. But none of it talked to this powerlessness. You know, the only thing that's going to talk of powerlessness is another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, armed with the facts about themselves. And that's what I found, you know, because of my next noble decision. I get high because I'm scared in that halfway house. And I wake up the next morning, November 10th, and I call my aunt because I'm pretty sure I'm going to need a back door out of this thing pretty quickly. And I cry to her, and I tell her things are getting bad, and I'll tell her I've relapsed because I'm working on staying on her couch. And she says, "Luke, I love you, but there's nothing I can do for you anymore." And that's the first time my aunt's ever said anything like that to me. You know, because my family's given up hope that things are going to be different this time. They start to say, "I love you," and they start to say their goodbyes, and I start to feel everybody getting further and further away. But she calls back a little while later, and she says, "I got a phone number for you. I want you to call this guy. He's not a junkie. He's just an alcoholic. I don't know if he can help you, but his mother said he'll try." And what it turns out to be is this. My aunt broke down in tears at her desk after she got off the phone with me. A coworker came up to her to comfort her, said, "Are you okay?" She said, "It's my nephew." And she said, "I thought he was doing so well. He was in treatment." And she said to this woman, she said, "Yeah, but he sounds hopeless now. I don't know what to do." And that just gives me goosebumps. And my aunt recognized that hopelessness before I did. It was a gift. Gift of desperation. So she says, "This is the phone number of my coworker's son. He's 4 months sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's going to try to help you if he can." And I pick up the phone and I call that guy, and he picks me up the next night and almost every night for the next 90 days and gets me out to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He gets me plugged into the home group that I'm still a part of today. He gets me plugged into the network of men that I still run around with, the ones that aren't dead or drunk, because not everybody's still sober. It wasn't all happily ever after for me and the guys that I ran around with. In fact, some days it feels like the guys that I'm close with, that group is getting smaller. You know, some days it's getting smaller faster than it's growing, and that's a scary thing. It reminds me that alcoholism is fatal, and I got to be doing something every day to treat my alcoholism. No, but when I got here, I didn't know any of that. What I did know is I needed a place to go. I needed somebody to follow around because I was out of ideas. Another huge blessing, right? First time in my life, I couldn't go to an idea that Luke had and my next plan for getting out of here. My plan B to date is this, guys. If Alcoholics Anonymous stops working, I'm going to Arizona. I'm trying black tar heroin because I've never done it before. That's my best thing. That's my ripcord. You know, if AA stops working, that's all I got for you. But I haven't found it necessary to go to plan B. You know, some days I've thought about it. But I got here and I got surrounded by a group of men that were taking action. I learned everything I needed to know in the first 90 days there is trust God, clean house, and help others. We've got 12 steps to help a guy like me do that. And I've heard things along the way that have really helped me, because when I got here, I thought there were 12 steps up to this huge spiritual experience where I was going to be enlightened and, you know, just a great guy. What I found and what I've heard speakers say before is the 12 steps are 12 steps down to humility. And on a good day today, I've got the ability to laugh at myself, you know. I don't take myself so seriously. And on a great day, you guys can laugh at me too, but only on a great day. I'll let you know when we have a great day. But I get in, I get connected to those guys, and I start following them around. The scariest moments that I had in the first 90 days of sobriety were at my home group when my sponsor would walk into the bathroom. I didn't know if I should follow him in there or not, or if I should just stand by the door. I usually stood by the door. You know, and things start to happen really fast. I'm in this halfway house. I get outed in the halfway house. I'd love to tell you guys that story, but it would take too long. And really what happens is this. Somebody from my past told somebody from my present something about me that I was hiding from everybody and I was confronted with it. And because I was working on inventory with a sponsor, it's 60 days of sobriety, which people told me was way too fast, with a sponsor that didn't have enough time. God entered into my life and started moving things around without my permission. He gave me an opportunity to see what things could look like if I just back away a little bit. I backed that third step prayer up with action. And the main action of that third step prayer is take your hands off of it, right? It's talking about this archway that we're going to walk through to freedom, the keystone, the thing that bears the weight from the top is this decision to trust God with my life. And if I could just not touch the walls while I'm walking through it, the more you stack up on that life, the heavier it gets, the more safe and protected I am. But if I start playing with the walls on the days that I get a little bit scared, those blessings that I have from Alcoholics Anonymous start to feel like burdens, and I start thinking of the ways I could take things out of my life because the job is too much pressure, and the sponsees are too much pressure, and the home group is too much pressure. These commitments are too much pressure. But they gave me a basis and a foundation in the first 90 days to walk through that stuff and keep my hands to myself. When things get tough, I got to reach for somebody else. I got to see who I can be of service to. And that was demonstrated to me in that experience. You know, I get added in this halfway house. I'm freaked out. I don't know what to do. And my sponsor starts talking to me about service. He says, instead of showing up to that home group and crying about everything that's going on and feeling bad for yourself, you're going to stand by the door, you're going to shake hands, you're going to make people feel welcome. And I knew at that point that this is why I don't get a sponsor with 4 months, right? That guy sounds like an idiot. What I thought I needed was like a one-on-one with a counselor, you know, more one-on-one time at the halfway house, a crew of responsible grown-ups who could talk to me about my feelings. I don't know. It wasn't service, I'll tell you that. That was not the intuitive thought that I had at that moment. But he told me to show up there and shake hands and make people feel welcome. And something happened. You know, it worked. I got out of myself by getting out of myself. I got out of that moment, that heaviness, that thing that has driven me to go and lay down and die so many times in my life. And I remember being like 8 years old and going out for Pop Warner football. And I remember walking up to the sign-up table. I used to think it was tryouts, but it was really sign-ups, right? Walking up to the table and that fear hits me. If I can't deal with this, it's too scary. So mom, take me home. And I hide in my room for the next couple of days. Until people stop talking to me about Pop Warner football. I don't want to talk about it. It never happened, right? I've run from jobs like that. I've run from relationships like that. I've run from situation after situation in my life because it was too big and it was too scary. And there's no amount of Luke applied to the situation that's going to make it any better. So I move away. You know, I run. And this was the first time in my life that I kind of stood my ground through this. And it was because I was doing a little bit of service. I had a little bit of feeling of I need to be there next week and show up at this home group because people are expecting me to be there. You know, just enough. Just a taste of it at about 60 days sober. You know, so I stick around through that halfway house and I have this experience where I see that God is really taking care of me, because the morning after this all happened, I wake up and the director of the halfway house came in to talk to me and she said, Luke, are you okay? And I said, no, I'm not okay. This is terrible. This is the worst day of my life. And she said, well, explain that to me. I said, you know what? A bunch of people yesterday found out something that nobody has any business knowing, a secret that I've been trying to cover up my entire life, and there's no way for me to put the genie back in the bottle on this one. And she said, do you hear what you just said? And I was like, yeah, I heard what I just said. What did I miss? And she said, you said yesterday was the worst day of your life, not today. And I said, what the hell does that have to do with anything, Kathy? And she said, yesterday was the worst day of your life, and you're still sitting here, you're alive, and you're sober. Do you know what that is? No, Kathy. She said, that's God. There's something taking care of you right now. If you just keep your hands off of this thing, you get a chance to see what life can look like. And for the past 6.5 years, I haven't gone back on that decision for more than a couple of hours or a couple of days to let go of this thing and let God call the shots, because I've found out through trial and error, right, because I don't do a perfect job at this, that on my best day, I'm playing checkers. I'm looking for the next hop to the next thing, the next little decision, the next little come up for Luke, the next little way to improve my life that looks like it's not a lateral move or a step backwards, always moving forward a half an inch at a time. That's what self-will looks like for me. It's not always ruinous. It's not always disastrous. I can string together 6 or 7 or 8 months of really good small decisions and pushing real hard in a direction. And I'm exhausted at the end of it. I've got 50 cents more an hour from my boss. You know, that's all it's ever netted me, really. But when I keep my hands off of things, God's playing chess, you know. God's got this thing so far in advance that he just takes care of me every single step of the way. And when it's all falling apart, that's when I know God's really taking care of me. I just don't ever know what's happening, right? And I've got a little bit of trust today. That hope that I had in the beginning that things could be different turned into a little bit of faith because I saw it demonstrated in the people around me. And by going through this crap by myself and coming out the other side of me and safe and protected, I've got a little bit of trust. And that's been huge. You know, I've got a lot of things going on in my life today that I can't take credit for. I would love to. Love to tell you their accomplishments, but they're not. They're grace. They're blessings. I went back to school a couple of years ago. I never knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. I wanted to be a massage therapist, apparently. And I'm doing that now. And that's like a crazy thing. Like, I show up at a job where people are happy to see me when they get there, and they're even happier when they leave. You know, they love me, and they pay me for it, you know. I get to make people feel better. And that came through prayer and meditation. You know, getting out of the way enough, removing ego enough. If you had told me a year and a half, 2 years ago that you're going to be a massage therapist, I would have said that's hokey. There's way too many jokes that could go along with that for a guy like me. A gay guy, a massage therapist? I don't think so. You know, I don't like to be the punchline of things. And my life is kind of a walking punchline today. And like the last couple of months, right? You know, in this decision to change careers, I ended up leaving a job. And I surrounded myself with a bunch of people that were talking about law of attraction and, you know, manifesting greatness in our lives, having a positive attitude. And I got all gung-ho. And I left this job that I'd been at for 5.5 years where they loved me, they respected me, threw me a going-away party. And I spent the next 3 months as an entrepreneur. That's French for unemployed, right? And I'm smiling the whole time because I'm working for myself and things are going great. And people are like, how are you? I'm like, it's absolutely awesome. And I'm dying on the inside because there's no money coming in and I can't tell anybody that I got to pick up a job, right? And on the tail end of that, I got to apply for public assistance for the first time in my entire life. I've made it through years and years of living like a degenerate without having to apply to the government for anything. And a couple of years sober, I got to humble myself because, to be honest with you guys, I needed the rental assistance. I didn't want the food stamps. I didn't want the health coverage. I just wanted the money to pay the rent so I could get out ahead of this thing a little bit. If you give me 30 days, I can self-will myself into this a little harder, right? I'm playing checkers. God's playing chess. As a result of applying for that rental assistance, I apply for health care. I apply for food stamps. I'm able to feed myself for the next couple of months. I get this health care. In the midst of this, another fear-based decision that kind of worked out, I decided to take part in a clinical study. So I'm not only am I a massage therapist, I'm a lab rat. For like $150 a month, I got to drive up to Newark and doctors take blood and they feed me all kinds of stuff and they check the levels and everything else. And it seemed like a bad idea after I started it, right? But my sponsor told me, you should probably see this through. And as a result of doing that, they find this underlying thing that I've had going on. I knew I had hepatitis C when I got here because, like I said, I did things other than alcohol. And back then they told me, don't worry about it. You're a young guy. You don't drink anymore. Things are probably going to be fine. So I took that as the sign to not think about it for another 5 years, right? Looking back on it, I probably should have been seeing a doctor on a regular basis, but I had no insurance until I applied for the public assistance. So I go to the doctor for the clinical study, and they say, your liver enzymes have quadrupled in the last 2 months. We got a problem here. And I say, uh-oh. And as a result of all this crazy stuff going on in my life and me just showing up and saying yes and doing the next right thing and praying and listening to a sponsor and walking through the fear, I walked away from a job that I was comfortable at for 5.5 years for uncertainty. And when it felt like it was all falling apart, it was just coming together. Because I just got approved for a treatment, a $120,000 medical treatment that is going to cure me of hepatitis C. That's 5 times my salary at this old job because I'll work for a title instead of a paycheck if you call me the right thing. If you call me boss man, you can pay me like crap. You know, so that's my best thinking. My best thinking keeps me living a life that's small. My best life keeps me in a thing that's comfortable and manageable that I can wrap my hands around and pull the e-brake on when it starts gaining too much momentum. But what I learned in the last 6.5 years is that when I keep my hands off of things, I trust God, I clean house, and I help others. God's always working behind the scenes as long as I'm taking care of his kids. So thanks for letting me share.